today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
And then next thing you know, I'm in a full-on fist fight in a bar in Ann Arbor and thrown into the street.
Hey, this is Jim Lenihan. Patrick Foster is off today and tomorrow, but I have very special episodes for you peoples, because the Tigers are in the playoffs. Yes, the Detroit Tigers are in the Major League Baseball playoffs for the first time in a decade, and that is cause for celebration. And this celebration led me to a man named Jim Whalewander. Okay. Whales, as they called him, was a utility infielder who played for the Tigers during their 1987 playoff run. He became a fan favorite for his scrappy play on the field and his personality off of it. One thing in particular caught my attention. He was a fan of punk rock, and one band in particular. On his Score rookie card, it reads, "It was Jim's offbeat approach to life that endeared him to his teammates. He became an instant legend in Detroit for his devotion to an obscure punk rock band called the Dead Milkmen." So how could you not like this guy? All right, so here's what happened. On Friday night, the Tigers clinched a berth in the playoffs. And immediately after that game, I was messaging with some members of the community here, the Rock and the Suburbs community. That would be Keith Jacobson and Mark Neese and Paul Trapp and Matt Carlson, all Tigers fans. And I joked in our messages about getting Jim Whalewander on the pod. Then Mark Neese chimed in and he said, "I heard Whalewander lives in Northern Virginia." And I'm like, "What? That's where I live, Northern Virginia." So I Googled and I found a newspaper article about a restaurant he had just opened with his son right here in the area called Chard. It's just right over in the next town from me, over in Herndon. So I stopped by the restaurant on Saturday and he was there, and we set a time to sit down for an interview on Sunday, just yesterday. And that interview is what you're going to hear today and tomorrow. Now, Jim Whalewander had a short Major League career, but in that time, he added to the legend of this storied Detroit Tigers franchise in his own way. And now we're going to bring you part one of my time with Whales. So welcome to Rockin' the Suburbs, Jim Whalewander.
Well, thanks for having me. We are Rockin' the Suburbs here out in Herndon.
Yeah, absolutely. So you, we're here at a restaurant that you co-own with your son.
Yes.
Called Chard.
Chard Restaurant. Yep. It's a hamburger place, though we are moving into other items besides hamburgers, but okay. We make the best burger around.
Okay. So we'll get into all that a little bit later. We'll
get into my sales pitch.
We'll get into baseball a little bit later. I want to talk about music first. This is a music podcast. Okay. And one thing you are known for is you being a ball player who was the Dead Milkmen guy. And it was even on your baseball card.
Yes.
That you were a fan of the Dead Milkmen. I want to get into that in a minute, but let's go back even further. You grew up in the Chicago suburbs.
Yes.
What kind of music were you into growing up?
Just about everything. You know, I grew up, it was the late 70s, so we had the hard rock, but then you start to expand away from that a little bit, and the Ramones were coming on, and all of that real, that new wave excitement away from that, the corporate rock of the late 70s. Though we still listen to it here in the restaurant, that corporate rock of the late 70s was something a lot of people were starting to shy away from, and looking at, oh, everything's all computer generated, everything. It sounds so quaint now because it was all analog world, but to have that real live person grinding it out without a mixer or anything, just putting it on vinyl was great.
Yeah. What year did you graduate high school?
1980.
Okay. So you were right there in that like late 70s period where, yes, things were starting to change, mm-hmm, a bit, right? But in suburban Chicago, You were probably a bit of an outlier getting into that kind of music, right?
Oh, a little bit, but you had a lot of kids listening to it.
Okay.
And so you could talk at school and things like that. But I did see Springsteen in 79, so it wasn't like I was totally. Right. And the Rolling Stones came through Chicago. You see them. So there was a lot of diversity in my music preferences, and it's still to this day.
Okay, okay. What attracted you to punk?
Just the energy, the feeling that there's a new way of doing things, and it's not like at the time, everyone was told to be successful, you had to go to school, mm-hmm. graduate high school in the top of your class, go to a great school, intern, work hard, and then you're successful. And these guys were just blowing past all that, going around it and saying, we're just doing what we want. This is how we feel. And we're screaming, yelling. And it was pure passion. And that's what drove me to it.
That's very cool. Was it different, though? Was the music you listened to different than your athlete friends? You know what I mean? It seems like at that era, you know, the kind of music that kids who were into sports would listen to may not be alternative, right?
Yes. But you have to remember, in the late 70s, there weren't Walkmen going around.
That's true.
Yeah. There was. So if we were on a bus going to a baseball game or a basketball game, it was the car radio or a tape player, or somebody had a boombox. It wasn't like sharing music or sharing anything. So you could stay pretty closeted as far as your music tastes on any type of team, because there wasn't that huge sharing that can go on right now.
Yeah, it was so funny because when you, like I said, when you came up and started playing for the Tigers, and for me, I was in college at that time and into all this kind of music mm-hmm. that you're talking about, yeah. Definitely way into punk. Just to know that there was a ball player who was like into the same music that I liked just seemed so different. You know, it's something I would not have expected. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, I grew up in Chicago, and Jim McMahon, remember him, the right. football player,
of
was
course.
The punk quarterback.
Right.
But he wasn't. He was a country music guy.
That's
and
right.
It's like, it got us all angry. It's like, what are you stealing our mojo for? You know?
Right.
But yeah, there was a chord. You know, looking back, and it's been years, looking back, there, I touched a chord somewhere in the world of disenfranchised people who didn't feel like, who were closeted music lovers like I was. And I just started to just play and do whatever. You know, when you make it to the major leagues, it's like suddenly you're king of the world. I can do whatever I want. I can say whatever I want. And so I knew I wasn't going to last long.
Okay.
I knew I wasn't going to last long in the major leagues because I was never given both respect. And it was also, I was towards the impetus of all that steroid stuff. And so I'm a little guy stealing bases, getting walks. No one wanted that. They wanted the 500-foot bomb. And so.
Yeah. Baseball was changing then, right? Yeah.
Sure was.
Yeah. What was your playing weight?
I said 165. I was playing in the minor leagues at probably 140.
Okay. Okay.
Because I could not keep weight on.
Okay. Because?
Of my metabolism.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that was not unusual for an infielder at that time, right?
No.
It wasn't. This was pre-A-Rod was, and all that stuff,
yes,
right?
Yeah. I was on the smaller side, but I wasn't, like right now, I would be a total outlier. But
right.
Back then, yeah, I was small. I used to travel with all the, with a huge bag. Everybody else had their baseball bag. I had a huge one because I had all the uniforms for all the bat boys, and they all wore my size. So I had all the uniforms, all the bat boy uniforms in my bag.
That's funny. When did you know, though, that you had enough talent at baseball to make something of a pro career out of it?
It was always a dream. But not to bore any listeners too far, but my dad played 1 week of minor league baseball in 1943, got drafted into the Marines, fought at Guadalcanal, fought at Invasion of the Philippines, fought at Bougainville, and then came back home without a scratch. But never played ball again. And so the minute we were born, my brother, me, my younger brother played baseball at University of Illinois. He taught us how to play. He said, he was always in my corner saying, you're as good as anybody I've ever seen play. So that was that confirmation. And one of the ironies is the wrong word. Interesting things about life is 44 years later, I played my first professional baseball game in the same city my dad played his last baseball game in Kingsport, Tennessee.
Wow. Oh, wow. Interesting.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I got drafted by the Tigers. They sent me to Bristol. Our first game was in Kingsport.
Uh-huh.
My dad's last game was in Kingsport, Tennessee.
Wow. How about that?
Mm-hmm. So just continued the cycle.
So you obviously played high school baseball and basketball.
Yes.
And then you went to Iowa State.
Yes.
My son goes to Iowa State.
Oh, Cyclones.
But they don't have a baseball team anymore.
No, they don't.
Yeah, but
I still haven't forgiven them for that.
Right. You played at Iowa State and then got drafted by the Tigers. And
yes.
I said went through the minor leagues, and including Toledo.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So
yes.
Okay. So when you got called up with the Tigers in '87, it was May, I believe.
Yes.
What was that like?
Again, let's talk about my father. I called. Like, I was the lowest paid minor league player. I spent all my money on a car, and I had nothing. And I lived in an apartment and just sleeping on the floor. And I went to a pay booth. Well, first, in order to get called up, they tried to call me, and then they realized I didn't have a phone.
It's not like today.
Right. So then the trainer comes to my apartment, knocks on the door, and he looks in, and I also didn't have electricity. So all I had were a bunch of candles lit in the place, and I'm sleeping on the floor. He's like,
"Is this in Toledo?"
This is in Toledo.
Okay.
He knocks in the door and says, "Holy fuck! What's going on in here?" And put some decent clothes on. You're going to the show, and that was it. And so then I got in my car, stop off at a gas station,
mm-hmm.
call my dad. My dad says to my mom, "Honey, get in the car. We're going to Detroit."
Yep.
So then I'm driving up north to Detroit. He's driving east from Chicago.
Right.
Get to the game. It's just a whirlwind of stuff. I kind of knew what was happening because Billy Bean, the one who just recently passed away, was a friend of mine. And I drove him up there when he got called up. And we were switching. So then I went up and took his apartment. And he went back and took my apartment. You know who got the better of that deal. But so I knew kind of the place where to go. I get there, whirlwind of excitement, and then thunderstorms completely rains out the game.
Mm-hmm.
But that thunderstorm allowed my dad to make it to the next day.
Oh, nice.
Because he would
have missed the first one.
Yes.
Yeah. So he saw your debut the next day.
Saw the debut, yes.
Yeah. By the way, that was the old, speaking of Toledo, that was the old Mud Hens Stadium. It was like at the county fairgrounds.
Yes.
It was kind of a dump.
Was it Lucas County,
I think. Lucas County, yeah. Yes. That was kind of a dump, that old one.
Yes.
They built a new one.
I once hit a foul ball there. It went up, hit one of these lamps, and it dislodged, and the whole lamp falling down. And like people run out of the way. And
yeah, it sounds about right.
Yeah.
Not quite as cool as in The Natural, right, where he hits the lights.
Right.
Yeah.
Wasn't nearly as cool as that.
So your dad got to see your debut, which, I mean, that's an awesome thing. But you know, what is that feeling when you're suddenly in a major league uniform and a major league stadium, you know, old historic Tiger Stadium, right?
Yes. The house that Cobb built. It was a little bit, there's a story of a frog in the hot water and you slowly turn up the heat.
Right.
And it's the same thing. You're just progressing. If from high school I went there onto the field, I would have freaked out.
Right.
But you had been playing in places like Columbus and all the other AAA fields. So, it certainly was a step up. And people talk to you a whole lot more in the major leagues than they did in the minor leagues. They just leave you alone. But it was just a subtle progression, not so much. You know, the players are marginally better, but they're marginally better at everything.
Mm-hmm. What about, though, you joined a team that 3 years prior had won a World Series?
Yes.
And was still pretty stacked with talent, you know? You had,
yes.
I mean, you were, I guess, unfortunate to be behind Trammell and Whitaker.
Very much
trying
so.
To earn a spot. But so. You also had guys like Kirk Gibson was still there, Jack mm-hmm. Morris.
Yes.
And so on. How did you fit in, I guess, or what did you do, I guess, to sort of fit in that environment?
I just was myself.
Okay.
Like, I get called up, and like all superheroes, I have a nemesis, and mine with Detroit was Bill LaJoy, the general manager. He comes in and sits down, and you know, before you come in, you sign your contract. He's like, you know why you're here? And I'm like, because I play hard. He's like, no, just don't do anything stupid or you're out of here. That was my welcome to the major leagues.
Wow.
From yes. I'm like, oh, okay, nothing stupid. You're talking to the wrong guy for that. All right. But anyways, that was my initiation. So I had my whole Tiger career was this push and pull between Bill LaJoy absolutely hating me and Sparky seeing a little bit of himself in me. And so LaJoy always wanted to get rid of me, and Sparky always wanted to keep me. And eventually LaJoy won.
Yeah.
But Sparky was a tremendous man. Like, after I got a little bit, he'd call me. It wasn't phone. It's like he'd yell from his office, right? Wells! And he'd say, meet me at this place tomorrow morning. And you'd go there, and he'd drive his big town car, and it's the children's hospital, and he's got a bunch of stuff. And he's like, the kids want to see Wales, so let's go and hand out. And so we're at the cancer ward all morning, and no one knew that he did this stuff except me, because the kids wanted to see Wales.
Interesting. Okay, so that leads – well, I was going to ask what Sparky Anderson was like, because the yes. guy's a legend.
Yes, he is.
And always seemed like a decent guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly that's the fan's perspective of yes. Sparky. So good to hear that
very
he
much
was.
A straight shooter. Yeah. Very much a straight shooter.
Yeah.
Like he told me when I – like that first day, was it like major leagues? My first day, I meet LaJoy, and he tells me not to do anything stupid. Sparky tells me, he's like, I know you can't hit. So whenever you're up to bat, you get the bat, you don't swing at the first pitch. You don't swing until there's one strike. And what was it? If it's 3-0, you're taking. 3-1, you're automatically taking. And 3-2, you get to swing. And he's like, and don't ever look at anybody for signals. You're mine. If I touch my face, you're stealing. Next pitch, don't even think about it. You get picked off, that's my fault. So he'd sit in the corner. If he put me in the run, he'd sit in the corner. And if he went like this, I'm running.
Mm-hmm.
And if I was on that leash the whole time.
Yeah, got it.
And well, everyone's like, you're a lousy hitter. It's like, I can't, 2-1, I can't swing.
Right, you don't have the green light to do that.
I'd never had the green light.
Yeah.
Never had the green light. 3-1, you're taking.
Interesting. But you did have a lot of speed.
Yes.
So you got put in as pinch runner often or pinch hitter later on?
Innings, I was right? never a pinch hitter.
Okay.
I was a pinch bunter because I could bunt.
Okay.
So he'd pinch hit me for someone to do a sacrifice bunt.
Got because it.
And then I'd play the position. By the time we ran around the lineup again, I was out.
Got it. But you mentioned, you know, going to that event and people wanting to see the kids wanting to see Wales and people want to see Wales. And a friend yeah. of mine yesterday, when I was messaging about this interview, you know, texted me a photo that he found of fans in the Tiger Stadium stands with Whale Wander, big banner there.
Yes.
I mean, you became a fan favorite in
yes.
that 87 year.
Mm-hmm.
So you're here telling me you couldn't hit, you weren't allowed to hit. Why did the fans embrace you so much?
That's a complicated question. I don't know. I think I was approachable like Sparky, they could see that I wasn't somebody like 6'11". Right. Or like Aaron Judge, where you're like, yeah, I bet he can't hit a ball far.
Right.
For me, I could walk just outside of the group of players and no one would notice that I was there. So something about making the most of the ability that you had and being able to carve a little sliver of yourself into baseball.
Yeah.
Maybe see a little bit of, you know, people used to tell me, I know I have a cousin who's like you. So
it's a bit of an underdog story,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
And people like the scrappy player, right? The guy who just plays hard.
Yeah.
No matter the circumstances, right?
Yes. And
get your chance and you make something out of it.
And yeah. That wasn't my choice, right? But in order to play at that level, I had to redline my engine all the time. Where other guys could be cruising along at 2,000 RPMs, I had to be hitting 8 in order to keep up with everybody.
Interesting.
So people think it's like, oh, this mental thing. No, if you want to be there, you gotta put the pedal to the metal here.
The relationship with management aside, did you love it?
It was 4 really fun years, you know, with the minor leagues with the Tigers, the major leagues with the Tigers, going back to the minors, going to the Yankees. I mean, it was quite a trip. You're single. You don't have anything else to do.
Right.
Like, I remember waking up in a hotel, calling the front desk and saying, where am I? What city am I in?
Right.
You were just on this big wave and riding it and just having as much fun as you could. Like, I got drug tested more than anybody, and I'm never into doing any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a lot of people abuse the amount of fun that you could have.
Right, right. So they told you, so LaJoy told you, don't do anything stupid.
Yes.
How did that work out?
We were always in oil and vinegar relationship. But Sparky was on my side. We were winning. And after that, I was going to say my freshman year, after the first year, we win the playoffs. And then why am I not on the playoff roster? It's not Sparky. It's Bill LaJoy.
Right, right.
He sent me down the last day and then brought me back 2 days later because Sparky wanted me for the run, but he did not want me on the playoffs. And then after the season, I'm released and put on waivers. Why is that? It was by the relationship with LaJoy. And then once Sparky got out of the equation.
So I will just say, as a Tigers fan, we could have used you in the 87 playoffs.
Yes, definitely.
And to the listeners who don't know, the Tigers had a come from behind last week of the season to catch the Blue Jays and pass the Blue Jays on the last game, I believe, right? And then go to play the Twins in the ALCS and fell 4-1, I think.
4-1, yeah.
Yeah. So, and you were left off that roster. So.
Right. I couldn't even watch it in the dugout. I was sitting in the locker room.
Yeah.
And with, like you said earlier, the team was getting a little long in the tooth, and they were, and they could have used some energy.
Right.
And they didn't have anything. They didn't have anything left in the tank. And it wasn't just me. It was Lucader was left off that playoff roster. And we provided a push of energy towards the end that the rest of the team didn't have. And then to leave that off the playoff roster was just a mistake.
Yeah, yeah. But what I was getting at earlier about the don't do anything stupid, did you not do anything stupid or did you do any stupid things?
I tried not to do anything stupid.
Okay, good.
You know, it's hard, especially with in a business that is so judgmental. You know, when the Dead Milkmen signed signed the record cover, Satan is my master. I had players wanting to either burn me at the stake and try and get me off the team.
Wow.
So you have this going on where you're just, you know, you meet the dead milkman, you hang out with them, they give you this stuff, put it in your locker, and now these guys see it, and the devout Christians that some of them are ready to, you know, burn me at the stake right there in the locker room.
Hmm.
And so I have to disavow all of it. It's just a joke, and I'm not a Satan worshiper, I promise.
Right, right.
All that. And so that balancing act was always difficult. It's always difficult because, again, in the 80s, baseball was very judgmental.
Interesting.
Judgmental. Like Billy Beane was the first gay baseball player.
Right.
He'll tell you.
Oh, I'm well, sure.
He can't tell you anymore. But and then I and Billy played the straight arrow. And I said, Billy, I know what you got because I got it all the time. All the time.
Interesting.
Yeah, the homophobia, the bullying, the grooming. It is unbelievable what was happening. And you just, you know, you smile and you're like, all right, that's not me. So we go on.
Right, right.
So there's a lot of craziness there.
Did that surprise you?
No, because I'd been in the minor leagues for 4 years before this.
Right.
So I knew that what the world and the judgments that were being placed upon me, and they were, from the minute I stepped onto the field, there were judgments, not just about my playing ability, about who he was off the field, which was absolutely crazy.
But you seem to embrace the off the field,
yeah,
you know, persona, right? Mm-hmm. You wanted to. Or I don't know if you wanted it, but you came off as somebody different. Like I said,
yeah.
I had a connection. It's like, hey,
yes,
there's, you know, Jim Wailwonder, he's a cool guy, you know, so
mm-hmm.
it meant something to me as a fan. So
yes,
you embraced that, right?
Yes, I did. And it was who I was. I wasn't going to hide from that. I wasn't going to, and it's, you know, it's just some new wave music, for gosh sakes, right?
Right.
But so just embrace it, be who you were. And like I spent a year of my life saying, I'm only going to tell the truth. And so that's how a lot of this happened. It's like, what are you doing? This is where I went. I'm telling people exactly the truth. I'm not sugarcoating anything. I'm not making stuff up. Yes, I was at a club until 2 o'clock last night. I left right before the police came. And there's another story. I was trying to date this girl from Chicago, and she was working at a Bennigan's.
Mm-hmm.
And I met one of the bartenders at Bennigan's, and he was a good guy. So he came up to Detroit, and we went to Ann Arbor. And then next thing you know, I'm in a full-on fist fight in a bar in Ann Arbor and thrown into the street. And I hear someone, and I'm hanging on to this guy so he doesn't hit me. And I hear someone say, they're calling the cops. I let this guy go, and he pops me right Ooh. In the face, right? And my lip goes up like this. And I'm like, oh, no. So then the next day, I go into the Tiger Stadium. And Dave Bergman's there. And remember, Bergman was a guy who, he went to the same high school. I knew his younger brother, but he was older than me. And Bergman says, what happened to you? I was like, told him the whole story of the girl in Chicago, the bar in Ann Arbor. And he's like, that never happened. We were out catching ground balls and one got you in the face. I'm like, thanks, Dave.
Right.
And so that pretty much ended my year of truth telling, but telling the truth is not always the wisest thing to do, especially around professional sports.
Right, but those days are far enough behind you now that you can tell the truth here.
Right? Yes.
Okay. Absolutely.
Yes.
No, but you did some funny interviews. I mean, that comes up when you Google, you know, Jim Wailwander and you read, you know, stories. It's like the funny interviews, almost kind of like John Lennon-esque, you know, in terms of like these retorts and things like that to stuff.
Were you stole John Lennon's line.
Oh, which one?
The one where they're like, reporter, I'm in Seattle. How'd you find Langston? I went in the on deck circle and turned left and there he was.
That's right.
And they laughed like they'd never heard that before. I'm like... Well, I guess you couldn't Google it back then.
That's right. But I mean, were you trying to be funny or were you just answering?
It was just,
okay.
Like, you know, I'm a second child. I didn't get that much attention. And so everyone wants to talk to me. So they're having fun with it. Why not? And so you end up having like friends of Mitch Albom and Bob Costas. Bob Costas used to hang around my locker all the time, just waiting. But I didn't think it was an interview. We're just chatting about stuff.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And he probably liked it because, you know, again, like here's somebody who isn't giving the same answers, right? The, you know, like the scene in Bull Durham where he's getting coached on how to answer questions, right?
Exactly.
And that's real. That's how most, you know, athletes answer stuff, very sort of vague and pat and all that. And here's somebody who has some personality.
Yeah. And it... And I don't even think it's personality. It's just being myself where everybody else was trying to be, just get this over with.
Right.
And don't say anything stupid. So Bill of Joy comes flying down with a ton of bricks on you.
Interesting. Okay, we're going to pause here. That's part one of my interview with Jim Wailwander. Tomorrow, you'll hear part two, including the story of the time he invited the dead milkman to visit the dugout at Tiger Stadium. You'll also hear about his one and only Major League home run. All right. So you're going to want to tune in for that tomorrow here on Rockin' the Suburbs. Today, though, we are going to play out with a Dead Milkmen song. This is from their 1987 album, Bucky Fellini. You heard the Beatles reference earlier in the interview. So how about we play this song called I Am the Walrus? On behalf of Patrick Foster, on behalf of Shadow, thank you very much, beautiful audience, for listening. I'm Jim Lenihan. This is Rockin' the Suburbs. We'll talk to you tomorrow. And go Tigers!
Fly ball, right center field.